You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Cerberus Capital Management is a wildly successful $26 billion investment firm run by Steve Feinberg, its famously secretive CEO. This past May, Cerberus bought the failing automaker Chrysler for $7.4 billion. But why would Cerberus risk its reputation and financial health on such a troubled company? Daniel Roth, a senior writer at Condé Nast Portfolio, went inside the secretive world of Cerberus for the September issue of his magazine, and he's here to discuss what he found. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you used to work for Fortune. Were you following Cerberus when you were at Fortune?
I wasn't. You know, Cerberus was really under the radar for a long time. They bought a lot of firms. They were very big in the private equity world, but they weren't a brand name. They're not KKR, you know. They until Chrysler, really, they were just a very smart buyer of distressed assets.
But bigger than KKR.
No.
Well, you described them as the ninth largest company in America.
No, no, I'm sorry. I'm saying that if they if you took all of the firms that Cerberus controls and you added them all up, they would end up being the ninth largest company in America. That includes Chrysler.
Now, so what sorts of things does Cerberus Capital Management actually do, and how much of it's devoted to private equity?
So it is a huge private equity shop. They have a hedge fund also, but private equity is really where they've been focused lately. And so in private equity, what you want to do is they'll take over entire companies, try to run them more efficiently, and then hopefully sell them in a few years or spin off various parts, make a lot of money for their investors. And what Cerberus's history was in buying companies in serious distress, and they would buy the debt of these companies and try to turn them around. And they ended up owning entire companies, so they had to figure out a way to actually run them. And what Steve Feinberg did that's been pretty innovative is find so much talent in the world of business, all kinds of executives who have bowed out of their various companies or sold their companies. He'll find them, he'll pay them enormous amounts of money and have them there as a brain trust. And then he'll stick them in the companies when he buys a company, have them run it. They can, because they're a private company, because the companies he's buying then go private, he can run them a little bit less under the attention of Wall Street and try to turn them around and eventually either sell them off or take them apart or do whatever he can to make some money out of them.
Well, this is the sort of thing that does draw a lot of attention, and yet Steve Feinberg is really secretive. He once joked that he'd kill anyone in the company whose picture appeared in the newspaper, and I'm not sure it was a joke. But why?
It's not entirely clear. He is very, very private. You know, privacy has helped him do a lot of great deals. There is not a huge benefit to a lot of these guys in being very public. They're not.
KKR isn't helped by it. When Henry Kravis shows up,
right. Doesn't
he automatically get a certain amount of recognition?
He does, and that's good for investors. On the other hand, these investors are pretty much, you know, they are skilled at trying to figure out what makes money and what doesn't. KKR is trying to go public, so there is, you know, Kravis has got to be out there. But Steve Schwarzman is certainly in the public eye now because he's got a public company that he's running. Steve Feinberg isn't doing that at all, so he can be secretive. That helps him do different deals, and he's just a very private guy. You know, I talked to his daughter, and she said, you know, my dad is incredibly private. He's very laid back, but he's very private. And she was hesitant to go on the record, but eventually did, And you know, I and other people I talked to for the story, everyone was terrified of him because they know that he's so private, and they know that he would want them to be private too.
Why would his daughter talk to you?
Well, you'll have to bring her on the show one day and find out. I don't know. I mean, I guess she just wanted to talk about her dad.
Were you able to speak to anyone who currently works at Cerberus?
Yes, I talked to some people off the record at Cerberus. I talked to some people on background at Cerberus, and I talked to a couple people at Cerberus who eventually agreed to talk to me for the story. But I got to tell you, I've dealt with a lot of people before who don't want to talk to me, but I've never dealt with a company like Cerberus before.
And you knew you weren't going to get Steve Feinberg to
talk to you. Oh, no, there wasn't even a shot of that. But they have this. The guy who's in charge of media relations, his whole role is to say no, basically. And Steve Feinberg at this investors meeting that he had in the spring said exactly that. He's hired this guy. His job is to keep them out of the press. So, you know, it's an interesting role for a press person.
Despite his enormous wealth, Steve Feinberg lives rather modestly.
He does. He's got a place on the Upper East Side, which is supposed to be a pretty modest condo or co-op. And then he's got a small home in Connecticut. And it is, you know, it's a modest home. It's a place that one of his employees might live in rather than this guy who's clearly worth, you know, clearly at least a billionaire.
I remember when Michael Milken first came on the scene and people talked about him coming to Manhattan from his home, I guess it was in New Jersey, on the bus every morning wearing a miner's helmet so that he could read all the spreadsheets in right. The darkness of the before the sun came up. And Feinberg worked for Michael Milken. Do you think that there is some kind of a connection with his thinking?
You know, I don't. I think that it predates his time with Drexel. If you look at what Feinberg was like in college, talk to some people he went to college with, and this is what he's always been like. He just is very, very intense. He is keeps to himself. He does not like a lot of people focusing on him. The one story I could find, in fact, where he's quoted was in his the college paper, Princeton, and he didn't say anything. You know, and since then he's just completely managed to kind of disappear.
Is there any transparency required of private equity firms?
Very little, and this is what one of these. You know, in the story I say that this is a that this deal terrifies Wall Street, and one of the reasons for that is because. Right now, Congress has basically told Wall Street, I mean, told the private equity firms, they're not going to be doing any kind of, there's no oversight. These are incredibly wealthy, sophisticated investors who put their money in private equity, and they're expected to watch out for themselves. So the government steps back and says, do what you need to do and make your money. You know, don't come crying to us if there are problems. But the fear is Steve Feinberg takes over Chrysler, 80,000 workers. Located in very important swing states. If he does end up stripping and flipping Chrysler, which would certainly be one way to make some money, Washington is definitely going to be asking hard questions and wondering, should we be regulating these guys? Should we be requiring more transparency?
My guest is Daniel Roth, the senior editor at Condé Nast Portfolio, and he's written an article called The Most Dangerous Deal in America for the September 2007 issue of the magazine. So this it's dangerous because of its possible consequences. We're talking about Chrysler being in Ohio and Michigan,
right.
Two very politically sensitive states, politically contested states. And if he starts, you say, stripping and flipping, that means firing a lot of people and then selling off a lot of stuff.
Exactly.
Which leads to more people losing their jobs, then anybody in Congress would, especially from those states, would immediately start saying, we've got to investigate.
Oh, yeah. And private equity is a very easy punching bag right now. I mean, it is a very populist message, and it's very easy to sell to people the idea that these private equity guys are making a lot of money on the backs of workers. So I think Feinberg Congress is definitely watching him, and if he decides to do what's in the best interest of his investors, possibly, but maybe not in the best interest of the representatives from Michigan and Ohio, then there's going to be some issues.
Well, Mitt Romney comes from a private equity firm, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, absolutely, from Bain. And I think that there have been some important questions raised about that, and I think that people have tried to make hay of it as well.
In the case of Steve Feinberg, he has hired a number of prominent politicians.
Right.
All top Republicans.
He's a very big giver to the Republican Party.
And he must have a lot of lobbyists in Washington who he feels are creating some kind of firewall for him.
Yeah,
there.
Absolutely. And he hired the same lobbyists, as a matter of fact, who convinced the government to save Chrysler in the late 70s, early 80s. And he's got him out there pressing Congress. He's really trying to do what he can to stop any kind of draconian increase in the fuel economy standards, which could really affect Chrysler, but even more so affect his investment in Chrysler.
Now, what does he gain from hiring some of these former top Republicans? I mean, I understand John Snow, former Secretary of Treasury, but Dan Quayle?
Yeah, I was stunned by this in my reporting that Quayle apparently is huge in Asia, that he has got a big following in Asia. He is the kind of guy that can open doors for them and close deals, and he is pretty widely respected out there, especially in Japan. So you know, while you probably wouldn't gain much by sending Dan Quayle into a company here in the U.S., send him overseas, and you know, he's the David Hasselhoff of Cerberus.
And do they does Cerberus do a lot of business with Asia?
They do. They do a lot of business in Japan. They are looking much more closely at doing deals in Asia. They want to be more prominent in Europe. They have to wait for certain. There have to be certain processes in place to allow them to take over these companies. A lot of countries don't necessarily want private equity to come in and take over their companies and remake them. And so there are certain rules that need to be dismantled for private equity to really succeed well in those countries.
How does Cerberus compare to other more public private equity firms like Blackstone Group?
Well, Blackstone is actually a little bit, you know, it's tough to compare these private equity firms because they invest in such different things and they...
But in the end, aren't they all doing the same thing, buying up these companies and then often stripping and flipping?
They are, but there are two... One of the important criteria that investors look for when they're investing in private equity is the amount of risk they're taking on. And with the Blackstone, you might be willing to take on more risk to be able to get greater returns. Feinberg uses pretty little leverage in his deals, although you wouldn't be able to tell that from this particular one in the Chrysler deal. But in the other ones, he tends to be less risky than a Blackstone. And because of that, his returns won't necessarily match Blackstone's. On the other hand, investors have less to lose possibly. But if you look at he's got four private equity funds. And if you look at them compared to the median of how other private equity firms have done, private equity funds have done in those similar years, he's beat all of them by pretty wide margins. So, you know, the strategy works.
Is it common for a private equity firm to leverage a takeover of such a large company? The Chrysler is huge.
Yeah, it's.
I mean, it's shrinking fast, but it's still huge.
Right? It was getting to be more common, but there was. I don't think that you're going to see it happen anymore. And that's the other really interesting part of this deal is that it's probably the last great. It is potentially the last great buyout.
Now, it must have occurred to Steve Feinberg that when he made this deal, he was going to develop a much more public profile, not only because he's buying a major American corporation, but also he then appointed Robert Nardelli to run the company. Robert Nardelli is not exactly the most invisible person he could have hired for that job.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. It just shows you what a thick skin Steve Feinberg must have, that he would bring in someone who's pretty much vilified in corporate America. You know, Nardelli doesn't exactly have the best reputation. And Feinberg has made, through his proxies, has made various noises to Detroit that he's really interested in saving Chrysler and building it and making sure that he works well with the unions. And he hires this guy who's just tough as nails to run Chrysler. And he's an outsider, and he's never been involved in the car business before. And he's got this sort of GE way of running things where everything is measured and people have to answer to him and in certain ways and very rigid. And
he didn't turn Home Depot around.
No, he didn't turn Home Depot around. He did very well for himself. But he did not manage to actually turn Home Depot around. And they're struggling right now trying to unwind the legacy that he left there. And I think Chrysler workers are pretty terrified by what having Nardelli in there means to them.
Let's take a little break. When we come back, let's go to Chrysler. My guest is Daniel Roth, who's a senior writer for Condé Nast Portfolio. His article, The Most Dangerous Deal in America, is in the September 2007 issue. In a little while, we'll bring you the next installment of our underappreciated summer reading series with a look at Roberto Arlt, an Argentinian novelist who had a huge influence on Garcia Marquez and many others. And then later we'll find out why marching bands are almost a religion in the Midwest. Also, the rich history of ancient Persia, largely forgotten not only in Persia, but also in the West. Or maybe I should have said that the other way around. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.
WNYC support comes from IFC Films, presenting Deep Water, a new nonfiction film from the producer of Touching the Void, about an amateur yachtsman's quest to win the first solo race around the world, Deep Water, in theaters Friday, August 24th. WNYC gratefully acknowledges the backing of our corporate underwriters and would like to add your business to our diverse list of supporters. To become a WNYC underwriter, contact Executive Director Vincent Gardino at 212-669-3013.
WNYC is a vital part of the New York cultural community. Join us in supporting local organizations, including Salma Gundy Club, a fine arts center offering exhibits, lectures, and art classes, Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center, promoting sportsmanship through education programs and events for youngsters, and Collective Unconscious, presenting emerging artists in the theater, music, dance, and film. For more information about the WNYC Salute the Arts program and its participants, click on events at WNYC.org.
We're back with Daniel Roth, who's a senior writer for Condé Nast Portfolio, a new magazine that looks at business from other angles. And one of the featured articles in the current issue, the September 2007 issue, is The Most Dangerous Deal in America, about the purchase of Chrysler by Cerberus Capital Management. Let's take a brief look at the financial history of Chrysler. How did the company go from barely averting bankruptcy in 1980 to buying American Motors in 1987?
Well, they were led by the very dynamic Lee Iacocca. They managed to they were bailed out by the government in the first place. They were put on good financial footing, and they figured out a way to just keep building. This was a time when they were one of the few American car companies to design cars that basically American consumers wanted to own. You know, they were one of the first to figure out how to compete with the Japanese.
So how did they lose all of that? When did they start to slip?
Chrysler went and had some serious issues in the late 90s, and they were one of their strengths became one of their big weaknesses, which was that they were building cars that were incredibly fuel inefficient. And
Japanese weren't doing that. Why weren't they noticing that about the Japanese cars?
You could ask that question about any of the American car companies. What happened was that they were making a lot of money, and American consumers seemed to have an unquenchable appetite for massive SUVs, and the Japanese were just smarter about seeing what was coming down the road, and the Americans didn't get it.
But that means General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, and yet Chrysler is the one that is in the most trouble.
Right.
Some industry people say that Chrysler shouldn't even exist, and they wonder what's keeping it afloat.
Well, one of Chrysler's big issues is they have no foreign presence at all. I mean, you won't find a Chrysler, a Dodge, or you can barely find a Jeep outside of North America. And so they are completely dependent on a market that's just not doing great. And Ford and GM both have pretty significant foreign presence.
Well, but Chrysler did when Daimler-Benz bought it in 1998 for $36 billion. Suddenly, it was connected to one of the most important European automobile makers there is.
Great idea, not well executed. And what you had basically was the Germans didn't want to share the Daimler-Benz people didn't want to share what they were coming up with the Chrysler people. The Chrysler people didn't necessarily respect what the Germans were doing. It was not a marriage made in heaven by any stretch of the imagination.
You have to wonder what Daimler-Benz was thinking. You buy a company that's troubled, you know it's troubled, and then you don't do anything to help it turn itself around.
I think they thought they could turn it around, and then it turns out there were, it's amazing, these huge companies, they don't just turn. You can't just tell people, here's who we are, we're now going to start sharing all of our pieces, and we're going to start sharing this and that, and people have, everyone's got turfs, and everyone guarded their turf, and there was just not a lot of cross-pollination that went on there.
I still wonder why. You mentioned earlier that Chrysler became successful for a while by imitating the Japanese. Why, when it became apparent that gas prices were going to be a big issue, why somebody at Chrysler didn't say, hey, let's find at least one engine that we can promote that will really give people good mileage?
I think, and I'm not an expert on Detroit by any stretch of the imagination, but there is, these guys, first of all, it takes a long time to be able to do something like this. It takes a lot of investment.
So you buy somebody else's engine.
Yeah, well, maybe you should. Maybe you should.
Well, they
appointed
Nardelli, not me.
Come in there.
I'm ready. As long as I have a really good golden parachute. I actually have right. one, a platinum parachute. Now, Daimler-Benz bought Chrysler for $36 billion. It's now sold the company for a little under $8 billion. It sounds to me like this is one of the worst deals ever.
Yeah, I think that I think it's pretty hard to justify how this was. You can't say this was a good deal. There's no question about it. There is, Daimler. Not only did Daimler sell this for, it was really $7.2 billion. Because what happened was Cerberus is investing $7.2 billion in the new Chrysler, and then Daimler in the end gets $950 million. $220 million of that comes from a mortgage that Cerberus has taken out on Chrysler's headquarters, and then they're turning around and investing all that back into Chrysler. Daimler's in the end losing money on this. It's actually a net cash outflow for them.
So in effect, they're saying to Cerberus, "We'll pay you to take
yes.
this company off our hands,
take
although
our company,
we're going to hold a 20% stake
right.
in it, which
right.
doesn't mean much anyway." And if it turns around, they make it back a little bit of their money with that 20%. But why would Feinberg agree to take over such an awful company? It's obvious that Daimler was trying to get rid of it.
I think he sees it as a great deal. I mean, he can, the hidden asset here for him is the financial company. Chrysler is really two companies. There's the car company, the one that we're all focused on. And then there's the finance company, which is the one that deals with helping dealers set up dealerships, helping people finance their cars.
But he already owns GMAC.
He has a majority stake in GMAC, so he could combine the two. He could find a way to get some kind of economies of scale out of that. He could basically, there's a lot of cash that comes into the financial companies. He can figure out something to do with it. He could sell off the car company. He can do things that Daimler Chrysler probably couldn't do because he's operating under the radar and with very little accountability. So he could, if he wanted to, sell the car company. There's a lot of rumors that Chrysler's doing business with Chery Motors right now. Chery's a massive Chinese car manufacturer. Who knows what the future is between a tie-up between Chery and Chrysler. There are a lot of things that he can do that Daimler couldn't do.
But there were things that he expected to be able to do that he couldn't do either. He expected a lot of people to help him out, people who have decided not to help him.
You mean the banks?
Yes.
Yeah, this is a... he actually got the banks to agree to about $63 billion worth of financing for the purchase. The first part of that was a $20 billion debt package that was then going to go out, and the banks agreed to it. So the truth is that Feinberg is not he's not hurt by this at all. It's the banks that he's been working with that are really stuck with all this debt. They thought they could unload on investors. And Feinberg got them all to sign off on it. So the problems are the banks, they're not his problem. And this deal was done at the last possible second it could have been done. Had he tried to do that today, the banks would have said, absolutely not, no way. And now they're stuck with all this Cerberus and Chrysler debt. They got to figure out something to do with it. He is his timing was either lucky or very prescient or both. I'm not sure.
My guest is Daniel Roth, senior writer at Condé Nast Portfolio. We're talking about his article in the September 2007 issue called The Most Dangerous Deal in America. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But if the banks start feeling like Feinberg pulled one over on them, they're going to be reluctant to do similar deals in the future,
absolutely,
aren't they?
I think that this is going to be a company worth watching. I think Cerberus is... the question is whether Cerberus can keep doing these big deals now that they've got the banks are on. They have a lot of exposure to Steve Feinberg and to Chrysler now that they didn't want to have. So would they be willing to step up to the plate and help finance Cerberus in the future? I don't know.
And I'm assuming that for Feinberg, one of the other things that may make this deal feel a little less great is that he's now subject to articles like the one that you wrote.
Yeah, I think that is probably not something.
Because there's no way he's going to stay low profile now.
I don't see how he can. I think that I see how he can. I just can't imagine that he will. There's going to be a lot of attention on him, increasing amount of attention on him, and I think a lot of the people in the private equity world are going to want him to step up too and start talking about their industry and why maybe things aren't as bad as the politicians say it is.
Has anything changed that we can see at Chrysler since Cerberus took over?
They brought back the star, the pentagram, so that's one thing. They cut inventory at the dealerships. Nothing major yet. I think at this an investor meeting, Wolfgang Bernhard, who was supposed to be a higher up Daimler Chrysler, and then he ran Volkswagen, and then he was talked about as being the next head of Chrysler, and for some reason it didn't. He ended up not doing it.
He may have decided it wasn't a good deal for him.
It's very possible. And he was talking about some of the great things that are coming out for Chrysler. They've got some new engines that are coming out in 2011 that are some kind of a new diesel technology. They're supposed to be greener, and they've got minivans and pickup trucks coming out that have helped them in the past. So there is this belief that Chrysler might have some good things coming. And the beautiful thing for Feinberg, is that he didn't pay for any of this. This is all capital expenditures that the Daimler Chrysler made, and he gets the benefits of it.
But 2011 is still a number of years off.
Yeah.
And the company is bleeding money.
Right.
So how does it stay afloat until something comes along that can help it survive?
I mean, this is why the private equity guys get into this, is that they think that they can either, if it continues to bleed money, either he'll hold it on his books and see an exit that he wants to use, or he'll flip it, or he'll, you know, sell various pieces of it and try to make some of that money back.
What does the recent burst of the credit bubble mean for Cerberus? Because this is a company that relies so much on debt.
It does. It means that they can't do these kind of big deals that they've started doing. It means, very directly, they have a huge... they are actually dealing... They're very affected by this, the credit burst, because of their exposure with GMAC, with GMAC, and with a mortgage company called Aegis that they own, which just declared bankruptcy, I think. And they, it's a huge subprime exposure at Aegis, and GMAC owns a lot of home mortgages as well. So Cerberus is actually struggling right now to sort of right both these ships. So that's one piece of it. And then the other piece is that they can't do these big deals. They're not going to be able to get the banks to sign on to massive deals anymore. Now, the silver lining for Cerberus is that their heritage is in doing... is in buying companies that are in trouble, buying the debt of companies that are in trouble, and working their way up to eventually own those companies and do something with them. So he's got a huge team of people who are exceptionally good at dealing with distressed assets, and he'll now start having these guys evaluate companies and start buying up some of this debt.
Has Feinberg, or Cerberus anyway, suffered in the past? Because there have been other times of economic turmoil in this country.
They have actually done really well during times of economic turmoil. That is when Feinberg has really shown, and this is what his people are trained to do. And you know, this was what they did with Chrysler is actually more of a departure for them than what they will be doing now.
Now, going back to something we talked about earlier, he has a modest house in Connecticut. In fact, you even have a photograph of it here, and nobody's head would turn going
right
past this thing. He has, you say, an apartment on the Upper East Side. I assume that's his pied-à-terre. What are his motivations? Is it, if it's not to spend the money, and he lives modestly, and he doesn't really benefit from the celebrity that many people
yep
crave with that kind of wealth, do you have any sense, speaking to his daughter or any of the other people that you spoke to, what is driving him to do this sort of thing?
I think that he is intensely, intensely competitive. He has, from his childhood, he has been someone who wants to win all the time in every deal. And he measures himself by how he's doing in these deals. And he's not measuring himself against a Schwartzman. He's not throwing huge birthday parties for himself. In fact, it's very clear that he can't stand what Steve Schwartzman does and how he acts. And you know, I think that whole comment you mentioned earlier where he says, if any of my people show up in the paper showing off their apartments, not only will I fire them, I'll kill them. It'll be worth the jail time. That was very clearly in response to the exposure that Schwartzman's had showing off his wealth. And so he's not competing in that area. He is competing in doing these deals and getting these deals. Apparently doing a deal with Cerberus is a complete nightmare because they want to win on every single point. And if you just go back even to when he was in high school or college, he played competitive tennis. He was an all-Ivy League tennis player. And they say he was sick for a number of years with an unclear illness, but he still played through it. He would wear eye black underneath his eyes when he would play tennis matches. No one else did that. He would practice. He was in ROTC, and someone told me that they had a they were having issues with their marching, and they just mentioned it to Feinberg, and he insisted they then practice. They were in the library, the Princeton Library, and he insisted they practice their marching right there. So this is a guy that is obsessed with the idea of being the best, of getting things done, and I don't think he's measuring himself by money, but not in consumerism, you know, in showing it off, but in how well he's doing.
Well, you had to go back to his college to get a photograph of him.
Yeah.
Is that the last photograph known of him?
It's the last one we could find.
From 1982. And
he had a little curly afro. You know, he's got a...
Looks like a nice-looking boy here,
yeah.
1982.
Yeah.
But if he walked into a room right now with Carl Icahn, everybody would know who Carl Icahn
right.
is, and nobody would know who he is.
Absolutely. Some of these guys, like Icahn, really, they use they are big public personas, and they use that to their advantage. And Feinberg absolutely doesn't believe it's something he wants to be. He needs or wants.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us today, Daniel Roth. His article, The Most Dangerous Deal in America, is in the September 2007 issue of Condé Nast Portfolio, the magazine that he is a senior writer for. And it's been a lot of fun. I'm going to continue watching what happens at Chrysler. But I must admit, this article did not make me want to go out and buy one.
Right. Well, thank you so much. This is great.
Coming up next, find out about the Argentinian writer Roberto Arlt, whose books are only recently being translated into English. That's on our underappreciated summer literature series. Also, I wanted to tell you about this Friday show. I'll be representing New York in the BBC's contest to find the world's most cultural or multicultural city. And you can help me by going to WNYC.org, where you can follow the links and leave a comment explaining why you think New York is the most multicultural city in the world. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also heard on satellite.